from college. The wheelchair had nothing to do with his cancer. The man had fallen down while coaching his youngest son's baseball team. In a broader sense, the Red Queen syndrome, moving incessantly just to keep in place, applies equally to every aspect of the battle against cancer, including cancer screening and cancer prevention. In the early winter of 2007, I traveled to Framingham in Massachusetts to visit a study site that will likely alter the way we imagine cancer prevention. A small, nondescript northeastern town bound by a chain of frozen lakes in midwinter, Framingham is nonetheless an iconic place writ large in the history of medicine. In 1948, epidemiologists identified a cohort of about 5,000 men and women living in Framingham. The behavior of this cohort, its habits, its interrelationships, and its illnesses, has been documented year after year in exquisite detail, creating an invaluable longitudinal corpus of data for hundreds of epidemiological studies. The English mystery writer Agatha Christie often used a fictional village, St. Mary Mead, as a microcosm of all mankind. Framingham is the American epidemiologist's English village. Under sharp statistical lenses, its captive cohort has lived, reproduced, aged, and died, affording a rare glimpse of the natural history of life, disease, and death. The Framingham dataset has spawned a host of studies on risk and illness. The link between cholesterol and heart attacks was formally established here, as was the association of stroke and high blood pressure. But recently, a conceptual transformation in epidemiological thinking has also been spearheaded here. Epidemiologists typically measure the risk factors for chronic, non-infectious illnesses by studying the behavior of individuals. But recently, they have asked a very different question. What if the real locus of risk lies not in the behaviors of individual actors, but in social networks? In May 2008, two Harvard epidemiologists, Nicholas Christakis and James Fowler, used this notion to examine the dynamics of cigarette smoking. First, Fowler and Christakis plotted a diagram of all known relationships in Framingham, friends, neighbors, and relatives, siblings, ex-wives, uncles, aunts, as a densely interconnected web. Viewed abstractly, the network began to assume familiar and intuitive patterns. A few men and women, call them socializers, stood at the epicenter of these networks, densely connected to each other through multiple ties. In contrast, others lingered on the outskirts of the social web, loners, with few and fleeting contacts. When the epidemiologists juxtaposed smoking behavior onto this network and followed the pattern of smoking over decades, a notable phenomenon emerged. Circles of relationships were found to be more powerful predictors of the dynamics of smoking than nearly any other factor. Entire networks stopped smoking concordantly, like whole circuits flickering off. A family that dined together was also a family that quit together. When highly connected socializers stopped smoking, the dense social circle circumscribed around them also slowly stopped as a group. As a result, smoking gradually became locked into the far peripheries of all networks, confined to the loners with few social contacts, puffing away quietly in the distant and isolated corners of the town. The smoking network study offers, to my mind, a formidable challenge to simplistic models of cancer prevention. Smoking, this model argues, is entwined into our social DNA just as densely and as inextricably as oncogenes are entwined into our genetic material. The cigarette epidemic, we might recall, originated as a form of metastatic behavior, one site seeding another. Soldiers brought smoking back to post-war Europe. Women persuaded women to smoke. The tobacco industry, sensing opportunity, advertised cigarettes as a form of social glue that would stick individuals into cohesive groups. The capacity of metastasis is thus built into smoking. If entire networks of smokers can flicker off with catalytic speed, then they can also flicker on with catalytic speed. Sever the ties that bind the non-smokers of Framingham, or worse, nucleate a large social network with a proselytizing smoker, and then, cataclysmically, the network might alter as a whole. This is why even the most successful cancer prevention strategies can lapse so swiftly. When the Red Queen's feet stop spinning even temporarily, she does not maintain her position. The world around her, counterspinning, pushes her off balance. So it is with cancer prevention. When anti-tobacco campaigns lose their effectiveness or penetrance, as has recently happened among teens in America or in Asia, smoking often returns like an old plague. Social behavior metastasizes, eddying out from its center toward the peripheries of social networks. Many epidemics of smoking-related cancers are sure to follow. The landscape of carcinogens is not static either. We are chemical apes, having discovered the capacity to extract, purify, and react molecules to produce new and wondrous molecules. We have begun to spin a new chemical universe around ourselves. Our bodies, our cells, our genes are thus being immersed and re-immersed in a changing flux of molecules, pesticides, pharmaceutical drugs, plastics, cosmetics, estrogens, food products, hormones, even novel forms of physical impulses, such as radiation and magnetism. Some of these, inevitably, will be carcinogenic. We cannot wish this world away. Our task, then, is to sift through it vigilantly to discriminate bona fide carcinogens from innocent and useful bystanders. This is easier said than done. In 2004, a rash of early scientific reports suggested that cell phones, which produce radio frequency energy, might cause a fatal form of brain cancer called a glioma. Gliomas appeared on the same side of the brain that the phone was predominantly held, further tightening the link. An avalanche of panic ensued in the media. But this was a falsely perceived confluence of a common phenomenon and a rare disease. Phone usage and glioma? Or had epidemiologists missed the nylon stockings of the digital age? In 2004, an enormous British study was launched to confirm these ominous early reports. Cases, patients with gliomas, were compared to controls, men and women with no gliomas, in terms of cell phone usage. The study, reported in 2006, appeared initially to confirm an increased risk of right-sided brain cancers in men and women who held their phone on their right ear. But when researchers evaluated the data meticulously, a puzzling pattern emerged. Right-sided cell phone use reduced the risk of left-sided brain cancer. The simplest logical explanation for this phenomenon was recall bias. Patients diagnosed with tumors unconsciously exaggerated the use of cell phones on the same side of their head and selectively forgot the use on the other side. When the authors corrected for this bias, there was no detectable association between gliomas and cell phone use overall. Prevention experts and phone-addicted teenagers may have rejoiced, but only briefly. By the time the study was completed, new phones had entered the market and swapped out old phones, making even the negative results questionable. The cell phone case is a sobering reminder of the methodological rigor needed to evaluate new carcinogens. It is easy to fan anxiety about cancer. Identifying a true preventable carcinogen, estimating the magnitude of risk at reasonable doses and at reasonable exposures, and reducing exposure through scientific and legislative intervention, keeping the legacy of Percival Pott alive, is far more complex. Cancer at the fin de siècle, as the oncologist Harold Burstein described it, resides at the interface between society and science. It poses not one but two challenges. The first, the biological challenge of cancer, involves harnessing the fantastic rise in scientific knowledge to conquer this ancient and terrible illness. But the second, the social challenge, is just as acute. It involves forcing ourselves to confront our customs, rituals, and behaviors. These, unfortunately, are not customs or behaviors that lie at the peripheries of our society or selves, but ones that lie at their definitional cores: what we eat and drink, what we produce and exude into our environments, when we choose to reproduce, and how we age. 13 Mountains. Every sickness is a musical problem, so said Novalis, and every cure a musical solution. W. H. Auden. The revolution in cancer research can be summed up in a single sentence. Cancer is, in essence, a genetic disease. Bert Vogelstein. When I began writing this book, in the early summer of 2004, I was often asked how I intended to end it. Typically, I would dodge the question or brush it away. I did not know, I would cautiously say. Or I was not sure. In truth, I was sure, although I did not have the courage to admit it to myself. I was sure that it would end with Carla's relapse and death. I was wrong. In July 2009, exactly 5 years after I had looked down the microscope into Carla's bone marrow and confirmed her first remission, I drove to her house in Ipswich, Massachusetts, with a bouquet of flowers. It was an overcast morning, excruciatingly muggy, with a dun-colored sky that threatened rain but would not deliver any. Just before I left the hospital, I glanced quickly at the first note that I had written on Carla's admission to the hospital in 2004. As I had written that note, I recalled with embarrassment, I had guessed that Carla would not even survive the induction phase of chemotherapy. But she had made it. A charring private war had just ended. In acute leukemia, the passage of 5 years without a relapse is nearly synonymous with a cure. I handed her the azaleas, and she stood looking at them speechless, almost numb to the enormity of her victory. Once, earlier this year, preoccupied with clinical work, I had waited 2 days before calling her about a negative bone marrow biopsy. She had heard from a nurse that the results were in, and my delay had sent her into a terrifying spiral of depression. In 24 hours, she had convinced herself that the leukemia had crept back, and my hesitation was a signal of impending doom. Oncologists and their patients are bound, it seems, by an intense subatomic force. So, albeit in a much smaller sense, this was a victory for me as well. I sat at Carla's table and watched her pour a glass of water for herself, unpurified and straight from the sink. She glowed radiantly, her eyes half closed, as if the compressed autobiography of the last 5 years were flashing through a private and internal cinema screen. Her children played with their Scottish Terrier in the next room, blissfully oblivious of the landmark date that had just passed for their mother. All of this was for the best. The purpose of my book, Susan Sontag concluded in Illness as Metaphor, was to calm the imagination, not to incite it. So it was with my visit. Its purpose was to declare her illness over, to normalize her life, to sever the force that had locked us together for 5 years. I asked Carla how she thought she had survived her nightmare. The drive to her house from the hospital that morning had taken me an hour and a half through a boil of heavy traffic. How had she managed, through the long days of that dismal summer, to drive to the hospital, wait in the room for hours as her blood tests were run, and then, told that her blood counts were too low for her to be given chemotherapy safely, turn back and return the next day for the same pattern to be repeated? There was no choice, she said, motioning almost unconsciously to the room where her children were playing. My friends often asked me whether I felt as if my life was somehow made abnormal by my disease. I would tell them the same thing. For someone who is sick, this is their new normal. Until 2003, scientists knew that the principal distinction between the normalcy of a cell and the abnormalcy of a cancer cell lay in the accumulation of genetic mutations, RAS, MYC, RB, NU, and so forth, that unleashed the hallmark behaviors of cancer cells. But this description of cancer was incomplete. It provoked an inevitable question. How many such mutations does a real cancer possess in total? Individual oncogenes and tumor suppressors had been isolated, but what was the comprehensive set of such mutated genes that exists in any true human cancer? The Human Genome Project, the full sequence of the normal human genome, was completed in 2003. In its wake comes a far less publicized but vastly more complex project, fully sequencing the genomes of several human cancer cells. Once completed, this effort, called the Cancer Genome Atlas, will dwarf the Human Genome Project in its scope. The sequencing effort involves dozens of teams of researchers across the world. The initial list of cancers to be sequenced includes brain, lung, pancreatic, and ovarian cancer. The Human Genome Project will provide the normal genome against which cancer's abnormal genome can be juxtaposed and contrasted. The result, as Francis Collins, the leader of the Human Genome Project, describes it, will be a colossal atlas of cancer, a compendium of every gene mutated in the most common forms of cancer. When applied to the 50 most common types of cancer, this effort could ultimately prove to be the equivalent of more than 10,000 human genome projects in terms of the sheer volume of DNA to be sequenced. The dream must therefore be matched with an ambitious but realistic assessment of the emerging scientific opportunities for waging a smarter war. The only metaphor that can appropriately describe this project is geological. Rather than understand cancer gene by gene, the Cancer Genome Atlas will chart the entire territory of cancer. By sequencing the entire genome of several tumor types, every single mutated gene will be identified. It will represent the beginnings of the comprehensive map so hauntingly presaged by Maggie Jenks in her last essay. Two teams have forged ahead in their efforts to sequence the cancer genome. One, called the Cancer Genome Atlas Consortium, has multiple interconnected teams spanning several labs in several nations. The second is Bert Vogelstein's group at Johns Hopkins, which has assembled its own cancer genome sequencing facility, raised private funding for the effort, and raced ahead to sequence the genomes of breast, colon, and pancreatic tumors. In 2006, the Vogelstein team revealed the first landmark sequencing effort by analyzing 13,000 genes in 11 breast and colon cancers. Although the human genome contains about 20,000 genes in total, Vogelstein's team initially had tools to assess only 13,000. In 2008, both Vogelstein's group and the Cancer Genome Atlas Consortium extended this effort by sequencing hundreds of genes of several dozen specimens of brain tumors. As of 2009, the genomes of ovarian cancer, pancreatic cancer, melanoma, lung cancer, and several forms of leukemia have been sequenced, revealing the full catalog of mutations in each tumor type. Perhaps no one has studied the emerging cancer genome as meticulously or as devotionally as Bert Vogelstein. A wry, lively, irreverent man in blue jeans and a rumpled blazer, Vogelstein recently began a lecture on the cancer genome in a packed auditorium at Mass General Hospital by attempting to distill the enormous array of discoveries in a few slides. Vogelstein's challenge was that of the landscape artist. How does one convey the gestalt of a territory, in this case the territory of a genome, in a few broad strokes of a brush? How can a picture describe the essence of a place? Vogelstein's answer to these questions borrows beautifully from an insight long familiar to classical landscape artists. Negative space can be used to convey expanse, while positive space conveys detail. To view the landscape of the cancer genome panoramically, Vogelstein splayed out the entire human genome as if it were a piece of thread zigzagging across a square sheet of paper. Science keeps eddying into its past. The word mitosis, Greek for thread, is resonant here again. In Vogelstein's diagram, the first gene on chromosome 1 of the human genome occupies the top left corner of the sheet of paper. The second gene is below it, and so forth, zigzagging through the page, until the last gene of chromosome 23 occupies the bottom right corner of the page. This is the normal, unmutated human genome stretched out in its enormity, the background out of which cancer arises. Against the background of this negative space, Vogelstein placed mutations. Every time a gene mutation was encountered in a cancer, the mutated gene was demarcated as a dot on the sheet. As the frequency of mutations in any given gene increased, the dots grew in height into ridges and hills, and then mountains. The most commonly mutated genes in breast cancer samples were thus represented by towering peaks, while genes rarely mutated were denoted by small hills or flat dots. Viewed thus, the cancer genome is at first glance a depressing place. Mutations litter the chromosomes. In individual specimens of breast and colon cancer, between 50 to 80 genes are mutated. In pancreatic cancer, about 50 to 60. Even brain cancers, which often develop at earlier ages and hence may be expected to accumulate fewer mutations, possess about 40 to 50 mutated genes. Only a few cancers are notable exceptions to this rule, possessing relatively few mutations across the genome. One of these is an old culprit, acute lymphoblastic leukemia. Only 5 or 10 genetic alterations cross its otherwise pristine genomic landscape. Thus far, the full sequencing of ALL genomes has not been completed. The alterations described are deletions or amplifications of genes. Detailed sequencing may reveal an increase in the number of mutated genes. Indeed, the relative paucity of genetic aberrancy in this leukemia may be one reason that this tumor is so easily felled by cytotoxic chemotherapy. Scientists speculate that genetically simple tumors, i.e., those carrying few mutations, might inherently be more susceptible to drugs, and thus intrinsically more curable. If so, the strange discrepancy between the success of high-dose chemotherapy in curing leukemia and its failure to cure most other cancers has a deep biological explanation. The search for a universal cure for cancer was predicated on a tumor that, genetically speaking, is far from universal. In contrast to leukemia, the genomes of the more common forms of cancer, Vogelstein finds, are filled with genetic bedlam. Mutations piled upon mutations. In one breast cancer sample from a 43-year-old woman, 127 genes were mutated, nearly one in every 200 genes in the human genome. Even within a single type of tumor, the heterogeneity of mutations is daunting. If one compares two breast cancer specimens, the set of mutated genes is far from identical. In the end, as Vogelstein put it, cancer genome sequencing validates 100 years of clinical observations. Every patient's cancer is unique because every cancer genome is unique. Physiological heterogeneity is genetic heterogeneity. Normal cells are identically normal. Malignant cells become unhappily malignant in unique ways. Yet characteristically, where others see only daunting chaos in the littered genetic landscape, Vogelstein sees patterns coalescing out of the mess. Mutations in the cancer genome, he believes, come in two forms. Some are passive. As cancer cells divide, they accumulate mutations due to accidents in the copying of DNA, but these mutations have no impact on the biology of cancer. They stick to the genome and are passively carried along as the cell divides, identifiable but inconsequential. These are bystander mutations or passenger mutations. They hop along for the ride, as Vogelstein put it. Other mutations are not passive players. Unlike the passenger mutations, these altered genes directly goad the growth and the biological behavior of cancer cells. These are driver mutations, mutations that play a crucial role in the biology of a cancer cell. Every cancer cell possesses some set of driver and passenger mutations. In the breast cancer sample from the 43-year-old woman with 127 mutations, only about 10 might directly be contributing to the actual growth and survival of her tumor, while the rest may have been acquired due to gene copying errors in cancer cells. But while functionally different, these two forms of mutations cannot easily be distinguished. Scientists can identify some driver genes that directly goad cancer's growth using the cancer genome. Since passenger mutations occur randomly, they are randomly spread throughout the genome. Driver mutations, on the other hand, strike key oncogenes and tumor suppressors, and only a limited number of such genes exist in the genome. These mutations, in genes such as RAS, MYC, and RB, occur in sample upon sample. They stand out as tall mountains in Vogelstein's map, while passenger mutations are typically represented by the valleys. But when a mutation occurs in a previously unknown gene, it is impossible to predict whether that mutation is consequential or inconsequential, driver or passenger, barnacle or engine. The mountains in the cancer genome, i.e., genes most frequently mutated in a particular form of cancer, have another property. They can be organized into key cancer pathways. In a recent series of studies, Vogelstein's team at Hopkins reanalyzed the mutations present in the cancer genome using yet another strategy. Rather than focusing on individual genes mutated in cancers, they enumerated the number of pathways mutated in cancer cells. Each time a gene was mutated in any component of the RAS-MEK-ERK pathway, it was classified as a RAS pathway mutation. Similarly, if a cell carried a mutation in any component of the RB signaling pathway, it was classified as RB pathway mutant, and so forth, until all driver mutations had been organized into pathways. How many pathways are typically dysregulated in a cancer cell? Typically, Vogelstein found, between 11 and 15, with an average of 13. The mutational complexity on a gene-by-gene level was still enormous. Any one tumor bore scores of mutations pockmarked throughout the genome. But the same core pathways were characteristically dysregulated in any tumor type, even if the specific genes responsible for each broken pathway differed from one tumor to the next. RAS may be activated in one sample of bladder cancer, MEK in another, ERK in the third. But in each case, some vital piece of the RAS-MEK-ERK cascade was dysregulated. The bedlam of the cancer genome, in short, is deceptive. If one listens closely, there are organizational principles. The language of cancer is grammatical, methodical, and even, I hesitate to write, quite beautiful. Genes talk to genes and pathways to pathways in perfect pitch, producing a familiar yet foreign music that rolls faster and faster into a lethal rhythm. Underneath what might seem like overwhelming diversity is a deep genetic unity. Cancers that look vastly unlike each other, superficially often have the same or similar pathways unhinged. Cancer, as one scientist recently put it, really is a pathway disease. This is either very good news or very bad news. The cancer pessimist looks at the ominous number 13 and finds himself disheartened. The dysregulation of 11 to 15 core pathways poses an enormous challenge for cancer therapeutics. Will oncologists need 13 independent drugs to attack 13 independent pathways to normalize a cancer cell? Given the slipperiness of cancer cells, when a cell becomes resistant to one combination of 13 drugs, will we need an additional 13? The cancer optimist, however, argues that 13 is a finite number. It is a relief. Until Vogelstein identified these core pathways, the mutational complexity of cancers seemed nearly infinite. In fact, the hierarchical organization of genes into pathways in any given tumor type suggests that even deeper hierarchies might exist. Perhaps not all 13 need to be targeted to attack complex cancers such as breast or pancreatic cancer. Perhaps some of the core pathways may be particularly responsive to therapy. The best example of this might be Barbara Bradfield's tumor, a cancer so hypnotically addicted to HER2 that targeting this key oncogene melted the tumor away and forced a decades-long remission. Gene by gene, and now pathway by pathway, we have an extraordinary glimpse into the biology of cancer. The complete maps of mutations in many tumor types, with their hills, valleys, and mountains, will soon be complete, and the core pathways that are mutated, fully defined. But as the old proverb runs, there are mountains beyond mountains. Once the mutations have been identified, the mutant genes will need to be assigned functions in cellular physiology. We will need to move through a renewed cycle of knowledge that recapitulates a past cycle, from anatomy to physiology to therapeutics. The sequencing of the cancer genome represents the genetic anatomy of cancer. And just as Firko made the crucial leap from Vesalian anatomy to the physiology of cancer in the 19th century, science must make a leap from the molecular anatomy to the molecular physiology of cancer. We will soon know what the mutant genes are. The real challenge is to understand what the mutant genes do. This seminal transition from descriptive biology to the functional biology of cancer will provoke three new directions for cancer medicine. The first is a direction for cancer therapeutics. Once the crucial driver mutations in any given cancer have been identified, we will need to launch a hunt for targeted therapies against these genes. This is not an entirely fantastical hope. Targeted inhibitors of some of the core 13 pathways mutated in many cancers have already entered the clinical realm. As individual drugs, some of these inhibitors have thus far had only moderate response rates. The challenge now is to determine which combinations of such drugs might inhibit cancer growth without killing normal cells. In a piece published in the New York Times in the summer of 2009, James Watson, the co-discoverer of the structure of DNA, made a remarkable turnabout in opinion. Testifying before Congress in 1969, Watson had lambasted the war on cancer as ludicrously premature. 40 years later, he was far less critical. "We shall soon know all the genetic changes that underlie the major cancers that plague us. We already know most, if not all, of the major pathways through which cancer-inducing signals move through cells. Some 20 signal-blocking drugs are now in clinical testing after first being shown to block cancer in mice. A few, such as Herceptin and Tarceva, have Food and Drug Administration approval and are in widespread use." The second new direction is for cancer prevention. To date, cancer prevention has relied on two disparate and polarized methodologies to try to identify preventable carcinogens. There have been intensive, often massive, human studies that have connected a particular form of cancer with a risk factor, such as Dahl and Hill's study identifying smoking as a risk factor for lung cancer. And there have been laboratory studies to identify carcinogens based on their ability to cause mutations in bacteria or incite precancer in animals and humans, such as Bruce Ames's experiment to capture chemical mutagens, or Marshall and Warren's identification of H. pylori as a cause for stomach cancer. But important preventable carcinogens might escape detection by either strategy. Subtle risk factors for cancer require enormous population studies. The subtler the effect, the larger the population needed. Such vast, unwieldy, and methodologically challenging studies are difficult to fund and launch. Conversely, several important cancer-inciting agents are not easily captured by laboratory experiments. As Evarts Graham discovered to his dismay, even tobacco smoke, the most common human carcinogen, does not easily induce lung cancer in mice. Bruce Ames's bacterial test does not register asbestos as a mutagen. Mice filter out many of the carcinogenic components of tar. Asbestos incites cancer by inducing a scar-forming inflammatory reaction in the body. Bacteria don't generate this reaction and are thus immune to asbestos. Two recent controversies have starkly highlighted such blind spots in epidemiology. In 2000, the so-called Million Women Study in the United Kingdom identified estrogen and progesterone, prescribed in hormone replacement therapy to women to ease menopausal symptoms, as major risk factors for the incidence and fatality from estrogen-positive breast cancer. Scientifically speaking, this is an embarrassment. Estrogen is not identified as a mutagen in Bruce Ames's test, nor does it cause cancer in animals at low doses. But the two hormones have been known as pathological activators of the ER-positive subtype of breast cancer since the 1960s. Beetson's surgery and tamoxifen induce remissions in breast cancer by blocking estrogen, and so it stands to reason that exogenous estrogen might incite breast cancer. A more integrated approach to cancer prevention, incorporating the prior insights of cancer biology, might have predicted this cancer-inducing activity, preempted the need for a million-person association study, and potentially saved the lives of thousands of women. The second controversy also has its antecedents in the 1960s. Since the publication of Rachel Carson's Silent Spring in 1962, environmental activists have stridently argued that the indiscriminate overuse of pesticides is partially responsible for the rising incidence of cancer in America. This theory has spawned intense controversy, activism, and public campaigns over the decades. But although the hypothesis is credible, large-scale human cohort experiments directly implicating particular pesticides as carcinogens have emerged slowly, and animal studies have been inconclusive. DDT and aminotriazole have been shown to cause cancer in animals at high doses, but thousands of chemicals proposed as carcinogens remain untested. Again, an integrated approach is needed. The identification of key activated pathways in cancer cells might provide a more sensitive detection method to discover carcinogens in animal studies. A chemical may not cause overt cancer in animal studies, but may be shown to activate cancer-linked genes and pathways, thus shifting the burden of proof of its potential carcinogenicity. Similarly, we now know there is a link between nutrition and the risk of particular forms of cancer, but this field remains in its infancy. Low-fiber, red meat-rich diets increase the risks of colon cancer, and obesity is linked to breast cancer. But much more about these links remain unknown, especially in molecular terms. In 2005, the Harvard epidemiologist David Hunter argued that the integration of traditional epidemiology, molecular biology, and cancer genetics will generate a resurgent form of epidemiology that is vastly more empowered in its ability to prevent cancer. Traditional epidemiology, Hunter reasoned, is concerned with correlating exposures with cancer outcomes and everything between the cause, exposure, and the outcome, a cancer, is treated as a black box. In molecular epidemiology, the epidemiologist will open up the black box by examining the events intermediate between exposure and disease occurrence, or progression. Like cancer prevention, cancer screening will also be reinvigorated by the molecular understanding of cancer. Indeed, it has already been. The discovery of the BRCA genes for breast cancer epitomizes the integration of cancer screening and cancer genetics. In the mid-1990s, building on the prior decade's advances, researchers isolated two related genes, BRCA1 and BRCA2, that vastly increased the risk of developing breast cancer. A woman with an inherited mutation in BRCA1 has a 50 to 80% chance of developing breast cancer in her lifetime. The gene also increases the risk for ovarian cancer, about 3 to 5 times the normal risk. Today, testing for this gene mutation has been integrated into prevention efforts. Women found positive for a mutation in the two genes are screened more intensively using more sensitive imaging techniques such as breast MRI. Women with BRCA mutations might choose to take the drug tamoxifen to prevent breast cancer, a strategy shown effective in clinical trials. Or, perhaps most radically, women with BRCA mutations might choose a prophylactic mastectomy of both breasts and ovaries before cancer develops, another strategy that dramatically decreases the chances of developing breast cancer. An Israeli woman with a BRCA1 mutation who chose this strategy after developing cancer in one breast told me that at least part of her choice was symbolic. "I am rejecting cancer from my body," she said. "My breasts had become no more to me than a site for my cancer. They were of no more use to me. They harmed my body, my survival. I went to the surgeon and asked him to remove them." The third and arguably most complex new direction for cancer medicine is to integrate our understanding of aberrant genes and pathways to explain the behavior of cancer as a whole, thereby renewing the cycle of knowledge, discovery, and therapeutic intervention. One of the most provocative examples of a cancer cell's behavior, inexplicable by the activation of any single gene or pathway, is its immortality. Rapid cellular proliferation, or the insensitivity to growth-arresting signals, or tumor angiogenesis, can all largely be explained by aberrantly activated and inactivated pathways, such as RAS, RB, or MYC, in cancer cells. But scientists cannot explain how cancers continue to proliferate endlessly. Most normal cells, even rapidly growing normal cells, will proliferate over several generations and then exhaust their capacity to keep dividing. What allows a cancer cell to keep dividing endlessly without exhaustion or depletion, generation upon generation? An emerging, although highly controversial, answer to this question is that cancer's immortality, too, is borrowed from normal physiology. The human embryo and many of our adult organs possess a tiny population of stem cells that are capable of immortal regeneration. Stem cells are the body's reservoir of renewal. The entirety of human blood, for instance, can arise from a single, highly potent blood-forming stem cell, called a hematopoietic stem cell, which typically lives buried inside the bone marrow. Under normal conditions, only a fraction of these blood-forming stem cells are active. The rest are deeply quiescent, asleep. But if blood is suddenly depleted, by injury or chemotherapy, say, then the stem cells awaken and begin to divide with awe-inspiring fecundity, generating cells that generate thousands upon thousands of blood cells. In weeks, a single hematopoietic stem cell can replenish the entire human organism with new blood, and then, through yet unknown mechanisms, lull itself back to sleep. Something akin to this process, a few researchers believe, is constantly occurring in cancer, or at least in leukemia. In the mid-1990s, John Dick, a Canadian biologist working in Toronto, postulated that a small population of cells in human leukemias also possess this infinite self-renewing behavior. These cancer stem cells act as the persistent reservoir of cancer, generating and regenerating cancer infinitely. When chemotherapy kills the bulk of cancer cells a small remnant population of these stem cells, thought to be intrinsically more resistant to death, regenerate and renew the cancer, thus precipitating the common relapses of cancer after chemotherapy. Indeed, cancer stem cells have acquired the behavior of normal stem cells by activating the same genes and pathways that make normal stem cells immortal. Except, unlike normal stem cells, they cannot be lulled back into physiological sleep. Cancer, then, is quite literally trying to emulate a regenerating organ, or perhaps, more disturbingly, the regenerating organism. Its quest for immortality mirrors our own quest, a quest buried in our embryos and in the renewal of our organs. Someday, if a cancer succeeds, it will produce a far more perfect being than its host, imbued with both immortality and the drive to proliferate. One might argue that the leukemia cells growing in my laboratory derived from the woman who died 3 decades earlier have already achieved this form of perfection. Taken to its logical extreme, the cancer cell's capacity to consistently imitate, corrupt, and pervert normal physiology thus raises the ominous question of what normalcy is. Cancer, Carla said, is my new normal. And quite possibly, cancer is our normalcy as well. That we are inherently destined to slouch towards a malignant end. Indeed, as the fraction of those affected by cancer creeps inexorably in some nations from 1 in 4 to 1 in 3 to 1 in 2, cancer will indeed be the new normal, an inevitability. The question then will not be if we will encounter this immortal illness in our lives, but when. Atossa's War. We aged 100 years, and this descended in just 1 hour, as at a stroke. Anna Akhmatova, In Memoriam, July 19, 1914. It is time. It is time for me, too, to depart. Like an old man who has outlived his contemporaries and feels a sad inner emptiness, Kostoglotov felt that evening that the ward was no longer his home, even though there were the same old patients asking the same old questions again and again as though they had never been asked before. Will they cure me or won't they? What other remedies are there that might help? Alexander Solzhenitsyn, Cancer Ward. On May 17, 1973, 7 weeks after Sidney Farber's death in Boston, Hiram Gans, an old friend, stood up at the memorial service to read some lines from Swinburne's A Forsaken Garden. Here now in his triumph where all things falter, stretched out on the spoils that his own hand spread, as a god self-slain on his own strange altar, death lies dead. It was, careful listeners might have noted, a peculiar and deliberate inversion of the moment. It was cancer that was soon to be dead, its corpus outstretched and spread-eagled ceremonially on the altar. Death lying dead. The image belongs very much to Farber and his era, but its essence still haunts us today. In the end, every biography must also confront the death of its subject. Is the end of cancer conceivable in the future? Is it possible to eradicate this disease from our bodies and our societies forever? The answers to these questions are embedded in the biology of this incredible disease. Cancer, we have discovered, is stitched into our genome. Oncogenes arise from mutations in essential genes that regulate the growth of cells. Mutations accumulate in these genes when DNA is damaged by carcinogens, but also by seemingly random errors in copying genes when cells divide. The former might be preventable, but the latter is endogenous. Cancer is a flaw in our growth, but this flaw is deeply entrenched in ourselves. We can rid ourselves of cancer, then, only as much as we can rid ourselves of the processes in our physiology that depend on growth, aging, regeneration, healing, reproduction. Science embodies the human desire to understand nature. Technology couples that desire with the ambition to control nature. These are related impulses. One might seek to understand nature in order to control it, but the drive to intervene is unique to technology. Medicine, then, is fundamentally a technological art. At its core lies a desire to improve human lives by intervening on life itself. Conceptually, the battle against cancer pushes the idea of technology to its far edge, for the object being intervened upon is our genome. It is unclear whether an intervention that discriminates between malignant and normal growth is even possible. Perhaps cancer, the scrappy, fecund, invasive, adaptable twin to our own scrappy, fecund, invasive, adaptable cells and genes, is impossible to disconnect from our bodies. Perhaps cancer defines the inherent outer limit of our survival. As our cells divide and our bodies age, and as mutations accumulate inexorably upon mutations, cancer might well be the final terminus in our development as organisms. But our goals could be more modest. Above the door to Richard Peto's office in Oxford hangs one of Dahl's favorite aphorisms. Death in old age is inevitable, but death before old age is not. Dahl's idea represents a far more reasonable proximal goal to define success in the war on cancer. It is possible that we are fatally conjoined to this ancient illness, forced to play its cat-and-mouse game for the foreseeable future of our species. But if cancer deaths can be prevented before old age, if the terrifying game of treatment, resistance, recurrence, and more treatment can be stretched out longer and longer, then it will transform the way we imagine this ancient illness. Given what we know about cancer, even this would represent a technological victory unlike any other in our history. It would be a victory over our own inevitability, a victory over our genomes. To envision what such a victory might look like, permit a thought experiment. Recall Atossa, the Persian queen who likely had breast cancer in 500 BC. Imagine her traveling through time, appearing and reappearing in one age after the next. She is cancer's Dorian Gray. As she moves through the arc of history, her tumor, frozen in its stage and behavior, remains the same. Atossa's case allows us to recapitulate past advances in cancer therapy and to consider its future. How has her treatment and prognosis shifted in the last 4,000 years? And what happens to Atossa later in the new millennium? First, pitch Atossa backward in time to Imhotep's clinic in Egypt in 2500 BC. Imhotep has a name for her illness, a hieroglyph that we cannot pronounce. He provides a diagnosis, but there is no treatment, he says humbly, closing the case. In 500 BC, in her own court, Atossa self-prescribes the most primitive form of a mastectomy, which is performed by her Greek slave. 200 years later, in Thrace, Hippocrates identifies her tumor as a carcinus, thus giving her illness a name that will ring through its future. Claudius Galen, in AD 168, hypothesizes a universal cause, a systemic overdose of black bile, trapped melancholia boiling out as a tumor. 1,000 years flash by. Atossa's entrapped black bile is purged from her body, yet the tumor keeps growing, relapsing, invading, and metastasizing. Medieval surgeons understand little about Atossa's disease, but they chisel away at her cancer with knives and scalpels. Some offer frog's blood, lead plates, goat dung, holy water, crab paste, and caustic chemicals as treatments. In 1778, in John Hunter's clinic in London, her cancer is assigned a stage, early localized breast cancer or late advanced invasive cancer. For the former, Hunter recommends a local operation. For the latter, remote sympathy. When Atossa reemerges in the 19th century, she encounters a new world of surgery. In Halstead's Baltimore Clinic in 1890, Atossa's breast cancer is treated with the boldest and most definitive therapy thus far, radical mastectomy, with a large excision of the tumor and removal of the deep chest muscles and lymph nodes under the armpit and the collarbone. In the early 20th century, radiation oncologists try to obliterate the tumor locally using X-rays. By the 1950s, yet another generation of surgeons learns to combine the two strategies, although tempered by moderation. Atossa's cancer is treated locally with a simple mastectomy, or a lumpectomy, followed by radiation. In the 1970s, new therapeutic strategies emerge. Atossa's surgery is followed by adjuvant combination chemotherapy to diminish the chance of a relapse. Her tumor tests positive for the estrogen receptor. Tamoxifen, the anti-estrogen, is also added to prevent a relapse. In 1986, her tumor is further discovered to be HER2 amplified. In addition to surgery, radiation, adjuvant chemotherapy, and tamoxifen, she is treated with targeted therapy using Herceptin. It is impossible to enumerate the precise impact of these interventions on Atossa's survival. The shifting landscape of trials does not allow a direct comparison between Atossa's fate in 500 BC and her fate in 1989. But surgery, chemotherapy, radiation, hormonal therapy, and targeted therapy have likely added anywhere between 17 and 30 years to her survival. Diagnosed at 40, say, Atossa can reasonably be expected to celebrate her 60th birthday. In the mid-1990s, the management of Atossa's breast cancer takes another turn. Her diagnosis at an early age and her Achaemenid ancestry raise the question of whether she carries a mutation in BRCA1 or BRCA2. Atossa's genome is sequenced, and indeed, a mutation is found. She enters an intensive screening program to detect the appearance of a tumor in her unaffected breast. Her two daughters are also tested. Found positive for BRCA1, they are offered either intensive screening, prophylactic bilateral mastectomy, or tamoxifen to prevent the development of invasive breast cancer. For Atossa's daughters, the impacts of screening and prophylaxis are dramatic. A breast MRI identifies a small lump in one daughter. It is found to be breast cancer and surgically removed in its early pre-invasive stage. The other daughter chooses to undergo a prophylactic bilateral mastectomy. Having excised her breasts preemptively, she will live out her life free of breast cancer. Move Atossa into the future now. In 2050, Atossa will arrive at her breast oncologist's clinic with a thumb-sized flash drive containing the entire sequence of her cancer's genome, identifying every mutation in every gene. The mutations will be organized into key pathways. An algorithm might identify the pathways that are contributing to the growth and survival of her cancer. Therapies will be targeted against these pathways to prevent a relapse of the tumor after surgery. She will begin with one combination of targeted drugs, expect to switch to a second cocktail when her cancer mutates, and switch again when the cancer mutates again. She will likely take some form of medicine, whether to prevent, cure, or palliate her illness, for the rest of her life. This, indubitably, is progress. But before we become too dazzled by Atossa's survival, it is worthwhile putting it into perspective. Give Atossa metastatic pancreatic cancer in 500 BC, and her prognosis is unlikely to change by more than a few months, over 2,500 years. If Atossa develops gallbladder cancer that is not amenable to surgery, her survival changes only marginally over centuries. Even breast cancer shows a marked heterogeneity in outcome. If Atossa's tumor has metastasized or is estrogen receptor negative, HER2 negative, and unresponsive to standard chemotherapy, then her chances of survival will have barely changed since the time of Hunter's clinic. Give Atossa CML, or Hodgkin's disease, in contrast, and her lifespan may have increased by 30 or 40 years. Part of the unpredictability about the trajectory of cancer in the future is that we do not know the biological basis for this heterogeneity. We cannot yet fathom, for instance, what makes pancreatic cancer